The Spark App Podcast, episode 48. This episode brought to you by a long pause. Welcome to the Spark App Podcast. My name's Carl.
And I'm Corey.
Good to see you, Corey.
Yeah, how have you been, Carl?
I have been fantastic.
That is good to hear.
How about you?
I've been pretty good. Keeping busy. Life is crazy.
Yes. I think Socrates said that.
Sure. You know what? If he didn't, he did now. Yeah, life is crazy. Yeah. Socrates.
Socrates. Yeah. All right, great. Well, okay, so for new listeners and for returning old friends or people that forgot to delete us from their podcaster app, I should probably explain what the Spark App Podcast is all about. And that is electronics.
Yeah, that's we're pretty much a one-trick pony.
That's it?
We have electronics down pat.
No, we don't.
No, that's why sometimes we bring in guests.
Yeah, because they know a lot more knowledge than us. Right.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this episode isn't one of those.
Yeah, it's just me and Corey.
It's just the two of us. Before we get started, though.
Yes.
I do want to release an informational bulletin.
Okay.
Carl and I are going on a trip. That's right. For the first time ever.
Yeah.
Well, no, not the first time ever, actually. For the second time ever, because we did the Analog Aficionados dinner. For the second time ever, both members of the Spark Gap will be at an electronics event.
Oh, I thought we were going to Hawaii.
No.
You never take me anywhere.
No,
nice.
I don't. We are going to Portland, Oregon for the Open Source Hardware Convention.
Yes.
I'm excited.
Yes.
So, if you happen to be in Portland on October 7th, I believe, and you see Carl,
yeah,
he will buy you a drink.
That's a terrible idea.
If you see me, I will point you to Carl so he can buy you a drink. So stop by, say hi. We'll be looking for people and we'll be just taking in the, Open Hardware Summit.
Yes, we will be there. We might even try recording a little bit afterwards or whatever. That is all true. But me buying you a drink is definitely a lie. So, but still, say hi.
He'll buy you a drink.
Anyway, all right. So let's start it off. Let's get right into part of the podcast.
Part of the podcast.
All right. So I guess I'm up first. The part I brought is something that I did not actually know about, which is, sounds ridiculous because it's a really simple part. I should have known about it. Maybe I knew about it at some point. There's a bunch of them. There's even a whole category on like Mouser and DigiKey for these parts. And that is current limiting diodes or current regulator diodes or constant current diodes. They're old parts. They've been around forever. I could give you a part number, but, you know, the individual parts don't really matter. Basically, what they are is a diode that, unlike a Zener diode, which regulates voltage, the current regulator diodes regulate current, right? So their construction is extremely simple. It's basically a JFET, a resistor, and a feedback from that resistor to the gate of the JFET. All right, so it's real simple. I'll give you an example part number, 1N5312, if you feel like Googling it. Now, I've seen it after I found the part because I needed a part kind of like this. Then I saw it everywhere. So I should have probably known, but all right. So why would you use a current limiting diode or a constant current diode? Okay. Let's take a very simple case. You have an LED and you want to light it off of a power rail of some sort. So if it's a 5-volt power rail and it's a 2-volt forward drop LED, you do the math, you throw the resistor down, everything's hunky dory. You know, if it's a 12-volt power, you just change the resistor, right? Well, what if that power rail is varying in voltage? So then you can't do something as simple as putting down a single LED to set the amount, or sorry, single resistor to set the amount of current flowing through the LED. So you could do something really complicated, like using an LED driver IC so that you can get a constant current through that LED or whatever. But an easier way is to put a constant current diode down. So you could spec a constant current diode that supplies 3 milliamps of current always, no matter what the voltage is on the power rail. So that way you can have varying voltage and your LED is going to stay at a constant brightness, right? You could also just put down a JFET and a resistor if you don't feel like actually putting down a constant current diode, just because some of the constant current diodes are more expensive than they need to be, especially when it's as simple as a JFET and a resistor, right? And then if you think about operation, JFET, it's going to be on normally, and then you have to apply a gate voltage to turn it off. So what ends up happening is you get that gate voltage by dropping voltage across the resistor, which is spec'd, right, to supply a certain amount of current. And then that voltage starts choking it off. So that's how it can feed back and regulate itself, right? So anyway, but the actual parts you buy are two terminal devices. So you don't have to worry about the gate. You don't have to worry about the resistor. It's just an in and an out, and it can do a constant current over a varying voltage. So very useful. Yeah, that's it. I mean, not a super complicated part, but you know, maybe it makes me look bad by saying I forgot all about these things or I don't remember where I last saw them, but used them recently and they're great parts. So, and it might solve a problem somebody has.
Yeah, no, I definitely think it's a cool part. It's not something that you would normally think about using, but if you, you know, sit down and think about it a little bit more, there are a lot of times when having a known amount of current is actually really useful.
Yeah, and I should mention that, of course, there's a Hackaday article where somebody used one to power some LEDs that were going into, like, a car radio, which makes a lot of sense because the voltage going in those LEDs could definitely vary. I don't know, 12, 14 volts, whatever it is. So, yes, it's been written. They've been written about and blah, blah, blah. You'll find a bunch of stuff on the internet, but here's one more place you'll hear about them.
All right, cool.
Yeah. So what did you bring, Corey?
So I also have an old part, although probably not as old as a JFET and a resistor.
Yeah.
But I know it's old because the part number is SN74. LVC1T45, which seems like a mouthful. But
yeah, what is it?
It is a single bit level shifter, which at first glance doesn't seem very useful. But the nice thing about this level shifter, it's bidirectional, and there are no restrictions on the voltage supplies on either side, which I think is really cool. So a lot of times you get a level shifter. Even if it's bidirectional, you'll have two voltage inputs, one for each level, and they'll say VCCA has to be greater than VCCB. So you can shift from A to B down or B to A up, and that's it. This part is cool because there is no such restriction on that. VCCA can be any voltage from 1.65 to 5.5. VCCB has the same thing. So they can even be the same. So you can shift from 3.3 volts to 3.3 volts.
Right, and then it's just a buffer.
Then it's just a buffer. Or one application I was thinking of is you can use a DAC in combination with some kind of power supply, like an LDO, and actually have a level shifter that will go to any level. So you have a microcontroller that outputs 3.3 volts or 5 volts for Arduino, and through this level shifter, you can output any voltage between 1.65 and 5.5 volts bidirectionally. which I think is pretty cool. So, simple part. It does support some decent data rates. If you're doing 3.3 to 5 volt translation, it goes up to 420 megabits. So, it's still pretty nice.
But they do it in baud rate, not in frequency. I guess that's what you're concerned about,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, I guess.
Right? Like,
I don't know. It doesn't really matter that much, I guess.
No, not really, but...
But I think it's still a pretty cool part. It comes in a bunch of different packages. They're all surface mount packages. But yeah.
Any simple. DIP packages?
No, no DIP.
Oh, okay. So even though it's a 74 series, it's an updated part that
they're not supporting the DIP
package anymore.
Yeah, the data sheet says December 2003 is when it started, so.
Yeah. Okay.
Not that old, but I think it's a cool part. I'll probably look into using it in the future because having, I like the Swiss Army part, Swiss Army knife parts that you can reuse in a bunch of different, on a bunch of different boards and just change the circuit a bit. And then it maybe, you know, it's the same functionality, but different voltage levels, things like that. I like parts like that because then I can test those parts, use those parts over and over again and build up kind of a rapport with that part that says, I'm using this part. I know this part is bulletproof. So here it is on this new board.
Yeah. Anytime you put a new part on a design, then you go to actually make it, that's the part that's not going to work.
Yeah, most likely.
Right. So
most likely.
All right, cool. Well, two pretty simple parts, but still cool. I mean, that's the whole idea of part of the podcast. It's not, you know, there's nice chips on Reddit and all that stuff, and they get into some pretty odd chips. But really, this is our opportunity to just talk about parts that we find that we like. They don't have to be made out of unobtainium and radiation hardened, you know, whatever.
And hey, maybe you could use them too.
Yeah. There's no law against it.
Yeah.
Yet. All right.
All right. So that was part of the podcast. So we are going to talk about, in my show notes, I called it design for test. Basically what we're going to talk about is, what are some steps you can take when you're designing a schematic and laying out a PCB that will be tremendously helpful when it comes to bringing that PCB up?
Yes.
Or debugging it.
Yeah, so this is not designed for manufacturing test, right? So that could be slightly different. I mean, you can do things here that can also translate to that, but this would be your first prototype build.
Yeah.
Right, you're not making 2 billion of these things. We're not talking about like automatic test equipment and blah blah blah. Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
We might briefly mention some ICT stuff, but
all right. Well, since you're doing so well describing it, let's get one from you. What do you got?
Okay. So, this may seem pretty straightforward, but one thing to remember is when it comes to picking a part, a lot of parts come in different packages.
Yep.
And it's very important to pick a package that is conducive to bring up. For example, I love QFN and BGA parts because they're nice, they're compact, they are good looking on a board. But good luck probing those signals when you're bringing things up, right? It's going to be... Well, for BGAs, it could be impossible. For QFNs, you're going to need a really sharp probe depending on the pitch of that. So a lot of times on first builds, I will pick a QFP part or, you know, SOIC or TSSOP or something that has pins brought out that I can actually probe with a scope or a meter. And worst case scenario, which I've had to do this before, I can lift the pins up and rewire them or just lift them up completely and not connect them to anything, things like that. So package selection.
Yeah, package selection is important. Now, sometimes you can't, right? A lot of those like battery monitors and battery chargers now seem to only be available in BGA. But the the tip that I have can be used for either TQFP or BGA and QFN, that kind of thing. But first I'll start with the TQFP, right? So, and BGA, but if you can, if you're making a prototype board and the board is larger than the final design, right? So we're not limited to how much board space you have. Try not to route the wires underneath the part. Reason being is on TQFP, it's not that bad, but like QFN might be pretty tough. So what I've had to do in some situations is unsolder one of the pins and lift it off of the PCB to actually be able to get it off of the trace, because maybe I accidentally shorted that net, or I need to wire that net to some other pin, and you know it wasn't the right pin, right? That can be avoided if you don't run the net directly under the part, so that way you don't have to lift the pin. Maybe you can just cut the trace. On TQFP parts, you know, an SOIC, it can be done where you actually lift the pin, but on QFN and BGA, there's no real pin to lift. So if you short a net, that's it, right? They're junk. The only way really is if it was a very small part and it was like QFN or possibly BGA, but small part, you could flip it upside down and then dead bug wire it to the board correctly. But who wants to do that? If just in layout, you make sure to kind of fan out your traces before going down into vias and don't go directly from the pad into a via or underneath the part into a via, even though it might create a larger PCB layout than you normally would. And you might think to yourself, I designed this, I checked it like a million times. There's no way anything's wrong with it. I don't want to fan out, right?
Famous last words.
Yeah, because it doesn't look pretty, or it has slightly higher loop inductance or something like that. You know, like slightly higher loop inductance is probably not going to brick your board unless it's some kind of sensitive high speed, you know, signal that, or whatever, you're doing something kind of fancy. But for jelly bean parts, slightly higher loop inductance is not going to brick your board. What will brick your board is if you accidentally shorted a trace that you can't get to now and it's shorting out your part. So the TQFP and SOICs are nice because, yeah, you can lift a pin, but also just fan out and then go down to vias. And then it'll, when you do run into an issue where you have to cut a trace on a board, you can do it, and you know, you can bodge wire the board instead of having to toss it.
Yeah.
All right. So that's pins. What else we got?
So like you said, sometimes you just can't, right? Sometimes the part you're using doesn't come in a QFP. It doesn't come in a dip. Or some kind of SOIC package. The only version you're getting is BGA. How do you still get access to those pins? So there are a couple different ways you can do it. My personal favorite, test points. And I mean the little loops that stick out of your board that you can clip an oscilloscope probe to.
So that's not a test point.
Test clip, fine.
It's a test clip, or I forget what Keystone calls them. They actually call them slightly different from test points. They call them like test loops or something. Yeah, those are nice. Most of the loop ones are through hole, though. But you can get like... Well, it depends what style, so I'll have to look up the name, but some of them are through hole, some of them are surface mount. They just call them slightly different things. They actually call all of the ones that are surface mount test points.
Yeah. Yeah, the nice thing about the loop is because I think It is a shared experience for electrical engineers bringing up a PCB. You don't have enough hands to probe everything you want to probe at the same time. Am I right?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, you know what? I was wrong. They're called test points through hole mount. Okay. Sorry about that, Corey. And then the other ones are called test points surface mount. I agree. Not only do you not have enough hands, you can never find a ground location that's close enough to where the ground lead on your scope probe will reach it.
Yeah, so that was going to be my next thing as kind of an add-on to this, is put lots of ground test points on your board. I usually put at least four, one in each corner of the board, assuming it's a rectangular board, just because, yes, those scope ground leads are tiny. They're so small, and it's always interesting when you have it connected to one thing and you're trying to probe something on the other side of the board, and you're bending the probe as much as you can to get every little millimeter out so you can touch down on that metal contact.
Right, and it makes sense that there's short. We're not saying that like scope probes should have really long leads on them. But it does make it tough working on a board where they have like one ground test point. And yeah, it's on the opposite side of the board. Pepper them around.
Yeah.
Because you can always pull them back off later. If you're going to make a Rev 2, or maybe, you know, maybe you use the surface mount ones, which are kind of hard to clip on as far as the ground lead of your scope probe. But I guess you could make your own like adapter or whatever to clip onto the smaller style if you want to use surface mount instead of through hole ones. But even if it's actually like going to production, you could always just not stuff them, right? You can always bomb option them out and it's just ground. But yeah, it's going to make your day a lot easier and like a lot nicer working on a board that has multiple ground test points on it.
Yeah. And I'll also say you don't actually have to go out of your way and buy specific test points. Like the loops are nice. At least I find the loops are nice because they're a lot easier to clip onto. But you can just use a regular header, just pins, right? They have both through hole and surface mount versions of just regular male headers that you could use. And that gives you a nice solid alligator clip thing that you can clip onto. The advantage I will give the loops over that is that a lot of times if that test point or header is in the middle of the board, when you clip your scope probe to it, a lot of times, depending on gravity, it could like slip off.
Yeah.
Whereas with the loop, it's not going to do that. So I will give that to the loops. But if you don't necessarily want to get fancy with a specific test point, just, you know, put a header on there.
Yeah, you could, or hey, if you really want, use a through-hole resistor.
Yep. Or that was your like, part of the podcast like a couple episodes back.
Yeah, use the zero ohm
through-hole resistor.
Yeah, I mean, or you just find one laying around and clip the leads off of it, right? And use that and solder it in yourself. Anything's better as long as it's actually, you have the ability to add them on the circuit board.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, what if you can't do that? You really want to, but I mean, even the surface mount ones, they take up a certain amount of space.
That's true.
What if you're on a very dense board? You know, you don't really have that much spare real estate to put on new parts.
Okay. I mean, I have an idea, but what's your suggestion? Well,
what's your idea?
Well, can you do a dot? You know what I mean? Can you do a surface mount test point dot?
So that's what I was thinking too.
Okay.
Is you basically put a circular component pad that is not solder masked and just have your trace running through it.
Yeah. And you'll see this on a lot of commercial hardware, right? They're not using them typically to bring up the board, not in the lab or whatever, but they're using them as test points in an automated test environment during manufacturing, right? So you'll see all these little round exposed pieces of copper, But just because that's why they go on, you know, mass produced boards doesn't mean you can't put them on your own board.
Yeah. And you know, it's one thing. I still always recommend having a physical clip for the ground because that's just invaluable. But you can take the clip part off of your probe and just jab at the little surface mount pad. And that will give you that. That works just as well. I mean, you have to physically hold it there. You can't just clip it and forget it. But it does work. The other thing is you can always take a small piece of wire and solder it to that exposed copper. And then you can clip onto something.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, alternatively, just put an extra cap on your design and then no stuff it. Right? Like on a power rail. If you really can't do it. Because a lot of times... sometimes you're really happy that you put like an extra cap on a power rail and then no stuffed it because you find out that that rail actually needs a bit more capacitance than what you put down. Right. But let's say that never happens. You still end up with two. If you no stuff the cap, you end up with two exposed pads, one of them power, one of them ground. And then you can use both of them as test points.
Yep.
Or solder, you know, wire to it. And, especially because it'll probably like go through reflow and be covered in solder anyway, so makes it nice and easy.
Yeah, and actually that's an idea for doing these surface mount test pads in general, is rather than going out of your way to create a specific, you know, component or test shape or whatever that does this pad, just use one of your existing components. And just no, don't populate the actual part there, but you can connect things to those pads, and there are your test points. Now I wouldn't pick like a 176 pin BGA to do this because that seems like overkill.
Well, and the other thing is, I mean, hopefully you're putting things on your board that need to be there.
Yeah.
I don't know how many boards you make that you put a part down that you're like, I don't really need it.
No, but I'm talking about like you have surface mount resistors. On your board. Well, rather than creating test points, just put a bunch of those down that are not populated.
Sure.
And use them as your test points.
Yeah. Now, if you are going to do it where, like, let's say you do a lot of, like, I2C devices have address pins, and you might want to be able to change it later. So you put a pull-up resistor on the address pin, and then you no-stuff a pull-down resistor on the address pin. If you're kind of thinking about it, and you're possibly going to use it as a test point or whatever, you could put like another little symbol next to it or something on your silk screen that that lets you know, oh, okay, this one's ground, right? So especially if you're going to do it with like a cap that's power and ground, and both power and ground are planes. Yeah, put an extra little symbol on there. It doesn't even have to say ground. It just has to be something that you remember that lets you know which side of this thing is ground. Because you don't really want to accidentally hook up the power rail to the ground side of your scope, right? That would be bad.
Yeah.
Because now you just shorted out your power rail. And same thing if you're going to use any particular part. And the idea from the get-go is that you're going to also use this thing as a test point. Granted, you might not think of this, right? And you might just luck out and not populate a cap, and then you can use it as a test point. But if you're actually thinking about it ahead of time, especially I find it useful with the whole cap trick, is put an extra symbol towards the ground side on the silk screen.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I'll talk about one that I've actually come around on. And that is, it's another power thing. I don't know why I'm on the power stuff tonight. But if you put down a power supply, on the output of that power supply, put a couple 0-ohm resistors or 1 0-ohm resistor.
You gave me so...
Right. So
much grief for doing this.
I used to be against it because you do a design where you're creating this power supply and you're trying to get it as clean as possible, and you want the lowest impedance, you know, on the output and all this stuff. And then you know, you want it to go and you want to decouple the plane and all that stuff and provide a bunch of bulk capacitance to the plane so that if there's a transient load, you can supply the amount of current you need, you know, with the caps. And then you ruin it all by just running it through this choke point, i.e. a single 0-ohm resistor. I still feel that way every time I do it. But on the first revisions of a board, I still put the 0-ohm resistor. Why? Well, because I make mistakes. And I could very well either have wired up the regulator improperly, so the regulator's grounded out or whatever. Something's wrong with the regulator or something's wrong with the rail. And you're probably going to want to do it for both the input and the output of that power supply. So let's say you do 12 volts to 9 volts, and then you do a 5 volt and a 3-3, you know, 5 volt off of the 9 volt and a 3-3 off of the 5 volt. Your 3-3 voltage regulator is shorted, but it's directly attached to the 5-volt regulator, which is directly attached to the, and then it brings down all of the rails. And then when you look at the problem, you can't tell very easily or quickly what power rail this short's on, because all your rails are down and acting funny. And everything's getting hot. If you do 0-ohm resistors on the input and the output, you can isolate those power supplies. I guess if you're worried about noise or something, put down a ferrite bead. Nobody knows how those work anyway, so that's where you might as well put them. Just something to where you can decouple your power supplies, input and output, at the very least on the first version.
Yeah.
The other thing, too, is if you're going to do this, which I say you should do it, even if you don't need it or you don't think you need it, if you're going to put down a resistor anyway, you might as well do a Kelvin connection on it and bring out either sides of that resistor to two test points or something, right? Reason being, I mean, you can do it without the test points if it's a big enough resistor, but maybe it's in somewhere tight or something. Reason being is maybe you don't want a 0-ohm resistor. You can pull that 0-ohm resistor out and either run it through your multimeter to determine how much current's flowing through out of that power supply. Or, you know, you put a low value resistor down there and then measure the voltage drop across it, and then do the math and figure out the current.
I was actually just going to bring that up, is that having that 0-ohm output, very useful for power supply characterization, because maybe you over-designed the heck out of your power supply and you don't need a 6-amp power supply. You need a 2-amp power supply.
Yeah, and that could be done, or you do it under, right? So I don't know about you, but I'm really terrible at determining how much power I need as a power budget of the components that are hanging off the power rail. Like, let's take a microcontroller, for example. All the microcontrollers nowadays are like, oh, in sleep, we only use like microamps of current, right? Or nanoamps, I don't know, right? They're all talking about how little power they draw during sleep. Okay, how much power draw does it consume during normal operation? And how much power draw does it consume when I'm turning on all of the GPIO or all of the GPIO I need for my design, right? The math, not the math, but the validity of the numbers that you're creating start getting pretty questionable. So you can either underspec the power supply or overspec it. And if you're going to put 0-ohms down there so that you can help bring up the board for test and that kind of thing and isolate it, yeah, you might as well. You can also use the determined amount of current. Another reason you would want to do that is as far as overspecking, let's say you put down a 10 amp DC to DC buck regulator on there, right? But you're only drawing, I don't know, 100 milliamps. Well, that could be kicking the regulator into a control mode that you don't want, right? So instead of doing constant current pulse width modulation, which is going to give you a nice clean output, because you're only asking for 100 milliamps and the buck wants to be efficient, it's going to start going into like pulse skipping mode or some other mode, right? There's also, for bucks, there's a, you can only like keep the FETs off for, you know, so much time, right? So your duty cycle gets too low and all that stuff. So anyway, possibly your supply would be cleaner if you didn't have the 0-ohm resistor, but the benefits outweigh the negatives, in my opinion, which is a changed opinion.
Yes, I was right.
Yeah, this one time you were right.
Yeah. So just a tangential aside to the microcontroller thing you're talking about, usually how I end up speccing it for the first rev is I pick the absolute maximum power into VCC on the microcontroller's data sheet. Because anything more than that, if it tries to pull, it'll just explode. So,
all right, that's a good tip. But then that might end up where you've over-specced, right? And you might end up being price conscious and you put in too expensive of a inductor or whatever you did. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So what else you got, Corey?
What else? So
seem
actually,
to be on a roll.
Yeah, so I actually do have something else. So kind of going back a little bit to the surface mount thing we were talking about. And then also in combination with you're talking about BGAs and escaping out. You want to escape out and then via down. You can actually design it so that the annular ring of your via, which if you don't know, annular ring is the amount of metal that you see around the hole. You design that to be a little bit bigger and then just don't solder mask it. So now all of a sudden your via has become your test point.
Yeah, that's actually really good. And it's also really good if the signal that you, or the signal on the net you want to test is something slightly high frequency, right? So you don't want to create a stub by adding a test point and then running a wire to that test point. So if that net already has a via on it anyway, just expose the copper.
Yeah, the only downside to that is you do have to increase the size of the annular ring. Otherwise, there's not going to be enough copper exposed for you to probe. And then you're going to end up trying to jab your scope probe into the hole and it could break the via. So.
Yeah, or I guess it could also break your scope probe.
Well, yeah, that too.
Which is also bad.
Depends on the diameter of the via, I guess. But I found that to be incredibly useful because it doesn't take up any extra space that you would normally do by putting on a surface mount pad, but still gives you that test point access.
Yep. Oh, one other thing too on power supplies. Always put an LED on them.
Yeah.
Just put an LED on it.
Yeah, especially the Rev 1s. In fact, you could put an LED on it with a constant current diode.
Sure, if it's a varying output supply. I mean, don't waste your money.
Yeah.
Not that they're expensive. Well, if you do. Anyway, yes, you could. But just put an LED on it.
Really helpful the first time you power up that board. You just look at the LEDs, and if one of them's off and it shouldn't be, then you know something's wrong, and you know where to start looking.
Right, exactly. But I see a lot of people, I mean, LEDs are so cheap now.
Yeah.
Just put one down, put them all over the place, right? You know, like, but of course, make sure that like you don't put a blue LED on a 3-3 rail.
Yeah, but blue LEDs are so cool.
Yeah, well, yeah, but it's not going to be any color LED because it's not going to turn on.
Yeah. How about a couple non-like electronic things that you can do? There are a lot of things that you can do to make your bring up a lot easier, and you actually mentioned one already, and that's when you're putting down a capacitor that you don't populate, you can put some silkscreen down on it to say, you know, which one is which. I love putting silkscreen on my boards. Now, I mean, I also love putting like pictures and stuff like that on in silkscreen, especially if you have like a big QFP package. There's going to be a lot of unused space underneath it. Put like a silkscreen picture down. It's like an Easter egg or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's beside the point. But, you know, label Label, label, label. So yeah, you might have your part number down or your reference designator that this, you know, power supply is, you know, PS7. It'd be really helpful if you also put like 5V in silkscreen next to that. So then you don't have to constantly be referencing, because I, you know, people who really love their designs might memorize all the reference designators, but I don't.
No.
I mean, I'll remember the reference designators of particularly problematic parts, but that's usually after I've done the bring up. So it's incredibly helpful to put simple things like, you know, what the voltage, what the output voltage of that supply is, or, you know, what the obvious things are, like what the buttons do. Definitely label those, but just simple things like that, pluses and minuses on capacitors. Or one thing incredibly useful, and a lot of parts already have it on, but if you have a diode, label which one's the cathode on the silkscreen, so you're not trying to, you know, figure out that on the fly.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it also makes it easier for your assembly house, right? Like, if you leave off the dots for the number one pins or the orientation for your diodes and stuff like that, you're going to have a bad time during assembly. One thing I will mention about silkscreen is it always prints smaller than you think it will.
Yeah.
So, you know, make your labels absurdly large looking when you're actually doing layout. Because when you produce the board, they're not going to be that big. And tiny, tiny silkscreen labels are just almost as bad as no labels at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say they're worse because they give you that hope of maybe I can read it, but you can't read it. You just, no.
No, you can't read it.
Yeah. And yeah, you know, that 0402 looks huge in Microsoft Paint, but it's not, right? That's a tiny part. So if your silkscreen might look equally large, but then when that board gets built, you're pulling out the microscope to read that silkscreen.
Are you doing your layouts in Microsoft Paint?
That's just, I call all the layout programs Microsoft Paint, because that's all it is.
It's pretty old school.
That's all it is.
All right, so I just have a tip that I think a lot of the electrical engineer guys don't think about, which is mechanical stuff. So test points are great. Tiny little 0402, 0201 caps and resistors are great and all that stuff. But if you put those parts right between two very large Z height parts, you're not going to be able to get your scope probe in there anyway. So if there is a sensitive net or some net that you would like to be able to probe, which should actually be all nets, honestly, on a prototype, if you're going to only route that net where there's between two very large Z height parts, you know, provide yourself a test point, some, maybe pop a via to the other side of the board if it's low enough speed to where vias doesn't bother the signal, you know, going through, because it'd be a slight stub or whatever. But try to think in three dimensions a little bit, which is what's nice with some of the CAD packages that do 3D export and spending time on and looking at the 3D picture. Typically doesn't matter to us or me anyway, as long as, you know, the mechanical guys are happy. But I have ran into situations where I just can't get my scope probe in there.
Yeah, I am incredibly guilty of this. I'll put down a capacitor that says 0805 with one thing in my mind, and then I get the board back, and it's huge. It's like a building. It's a very tall cap. I mean, yes, it's an 0805, but it's really tall.
Yeah, I was also just thinking, I was thinking more along the lines of like aluminum electrolytics, right? Caps, you put those down and then you kind of forget that they're pretty tall.
Yeah. Or inductors inductors can be pretty tall.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of the big parts on my tall parts on my boards are the aluminum electrolytics. And I've ran into a situation where I have like a grouping of them. Let's say I keep bringing up power.
Well, I mean, power is one of the biggest bring up things.
That's usually what goes wrong on boards is it starts, you know, lights on fire and everybody dies.
Take a picture. Anytime it lights on fire, take a picture.
Yeah. Like, okay, so let's say you're looking at you want to look at the feedback node of a power supply, but the feedback resistors are attached to the output of that power supply, and you have a whole bunch of aluminum electrolytics on the output of the power supply, and you put that feedback resistor right in between two of the aluminum electrolytics, well, you're never going to be able to get a scope probe in there. Or if you want to do loop gain analysis on it, which you usually put down a small resistor and inject a signal across it or whatever, you're never going to be able to do that because you have aluminum electrolytics stuck all over the place. And you can't actually get into it because you run into Z height problems. So, you know, not really, it's more of a mechanical thing really. But think about it before you make the board and then it'll make bring up faster. And then another mechanical thing, buy yourself a pan of ice.
Oh my gosh. Pan of ices are brilliant. I think we've talked about it before on the podcast. It's a fantastic Christmas gift for that electrical engineer in your life.
Yeah. Now, they're too expensive. They cost too much money, right? But buy it before you get the board. Or I saw Hackaday has a, no sponsor, but I saw that they have some vice that I wanted to check out. It's just like a sliding kind of little vice thing that holds the circuit boards, but something that you can hold the circuit board with and flip the circuit board over and then be able to apply pressure to it using scope probes, right? Because it comes down to that Z height thing. Well, you really shouldn't just lay a circuit board on your lab bench and start pressing on it with different scope probes. You could, you know, snap a part right off of it. And then, you know, maybe you're good about the top side, but then you need to get to the bottom side. Anyway, long story short, get something to hold your circuit boards before you ever get that circuit board back, because you're going to want to probe it. And I don't want you probing it on just a wooden table.
Yeah. I think my last word of wisdom here is if you are laying out your board, don't feel free to experiment depending on, you know, how critical the board is, whatnot, but you can draw shapes in more than just metal. And most importantly, I'm talking about solder mask relief. You don't necessarily have to add in anything to a power plane. Like if you have a pour of power on the top or bottom, one of the outer layers, you can just relieve a little bit of solder mask and boom, there's your test point. You don't necessarily have to add another component or do things like that. You know, add stuff in silkscreen, add stuff in solder mask, or rather remove stuff because it's a negative layer, but you know what I mean. Do things outside of etch. And you'll find tricks that make your bring up just so much easier.
Yeah. Now I'm going to inject here that you don't have to listen to us about any of this stuff.
Well, that just kind of goes without saying.
No, okay. I know. But I mean, we're given advice. Take it as you will. If you only do one of these things on your next board, let us know how it goes. You don't have to do all of them, right? Some things you just don't want to do. You don't have to do it. I forget to do them. So
if you only do one thing, put ground clips on your board.
Yeah.
I would say
if
that's
you
the
want
one
to
thing.
Have a good time, yeah. Right? I'm not going to look at your circuit board. I'm not going to help you debug it unless you buy me a lot of beers. And then my advice is going to be terrible anyway because I'm going to be drunk.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can do all this stuff if you want. I did have another suggestion, which is your favorite kind of suggestion, Corey, which is software related.
Oh,
Yeah, kind
of. Why is that my favorite kind of suggestion?
Because, you know, you're like a software guy, right?
Oh, get out of here. Get out of here.
Aren't you like a Java programmer, right? Oh,
God, just get out.
Never learn how to use a pointer.
Just leave.
Anyway. software.
Anyway, what's your software solution?
All right, if you got a microcontroller and it's got extra pins on it, and you can assign those pins to a UART, bring them out to a header, even if you were never going to use that UART for anything, right? And, you know, this one, I almost don't need to say, because if you look at a lot of commercial products, they have a hidden UART header, usually on the board with an unpopulated connector on it. A lot of them are. Well, why do they do that, right? Sure, you can use a debugger and you can step through code and set breakpoints and all that kind of thing. Or you can do it the lazy man way and just put some printfs in there. And then hook up like an FTDI, you know, USB to UART, you know, TTL level UART to it. And then now you have an extra console.
Yeah.
Right? So for bring up, okay, maybe your device is supposed to be Bluetooth only. Or it's supposed to be, you know, I don't know, Zigbee or something, right? But give yourself another in or another out of that thing to determine what's going wrong with it. And if you're doing like a shared situation where you're just the electronic guy and then you have a software or firmware guy, right? Maybe you're in a startup or, you know, whatever. I don't know. Even if he doesn't want it, give it to him. Because they're going to want it. And that
you will be the hero of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you have extra pins, bring them out. Even if you don't have the room, bring them out to test points. If you bring them out to a tiny 0201 test point, I guarantee you, if there's something wrong and you need that UART, somebody will find a way to solder wires to that thing.
That does remind me, I will, one thing that I've run into personally, so this is, you know, a lesson that I've learned, if your test point pad, if you're using a surface mount test point pad, and it's a tiny little test point pad, you're maybe going to get one good solder on that.
Yep.
Before that pad just rips completely off the board.
It's true.
So I recommend making your test point pads a little bit bigger. Don't just use an 0201. Because that thing's going to come right off the board.
Well, alternatively, you do not have to solder wires to it. There is our friendly pogo pin. So for something like a UART, pogo pin's a pin with a little spring in it, right? Applies a certain amount of force down to the board. You can get creative with pogo pins and hot glue and wire wrap wire and that kind of stuff. And you can make up a little jig that goes down and touches those test points. You know, big like commercial manufacturing or whatever, they're using like the same thing, right? It's pogo pins. Just they use it in a fancy fixture. Well, you can make up your own poor man's fixture. And you might want to do that if you're dealing with those tiny 0201 test pads. Because what feels even worse, and I've done it too, and Corey just said he's done it, and I'll admit to doing it too, is you had the test pad, you go to use it, and then you no longer have the test pad.
Yeah.
That feels almost worse than never putting the test pad down to begin with.
Especially if, like... So this has happened to me before. I've gotten, I had a board. This was my only board. This is the only board. I needed to bring it up. It wasn't in a configuration I wanted, but there was a test point that I could use to put it in the configuration I wanted. And I got everything soldered down and everything was, you know, wrapped up in tape. So it was all nice and stable. And I hook it all up and it's not working right. So I go to slightly like look underneath the tape. Nope, it's gone.
Yeah,
it's gone. It was my only board. Oh my gosh, I was.
Yeah, so don't be us. This is the lesson of the week, and yeah. I think that's a good lesson to end on. Is the more of these things you even if you don't do it, you might not do it on your next board, but the board after that, you're probably going to start adding some of these. I'd be interested to hear our audience's tips, because I'm sure you guys probably have, you know, some of you have way more experience than we do. These are just the things that we've learned after bricking a couple and making a couple coasters. So if you want...
I've made a couple toasters, too.
Have you made a toaster?
Well, you know, if the board gets hot enough.
Oh, that's true. I've done that, too. Yeah. I've made a couple barbecue smokers, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, if you want, feel free. You could write us. Just email show@thesparkapp.net. You can reach us on the Twitters. Just look for @thesparkapp. Or you can leave a comment on this post, sparkapp.net.
Yeah. And just a reminder, yeah, we'll be in Portland on October 7th. We hope to see you there. If you show us a board that has some ground clip test points on it, Carl will buy you a drink.
Yeah. So I'll say this. I'll buy you a drink on this one, on one actual requirement. So we're thinking about recording at the Open Source Hardware Summit, but we don't want to be lame about it, right? Like, we're not going to go there with like big giant microphones and be like, ah, Mr. Man on the Street, you know, like, what do you say, fellow EE? We're not trying to do that. Really, we just wanted to go to the Open Source Hardware Summit because it's cool. I've gone before. I went to the one in Boston, had a great time. Missed the one in Philadelphia. Of all things,
yeah,
I missed the one in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
I can't wait to go to this one. But we might, I'm bringing some of the recording equipment, just a little bit of our like travel equipment. So if you have a project and you want to talk about it, if you find me and say, hey, I'd like to talk about it on your podcast. We're thinking about possibly doing it after the conference at like Friday night, maybe. After the bar or before the bar, I don't know, I'm not sure, or maybe at the bar. So anyway, long story short, if you see me, you want to talk about your project, you want to do it on quote unquote air, I'll buy you a beer.
Or drink, or, you know, non-alcoholic beverage. We don't discriminate.
Yeah. Beer or soda, no $20 vodka and Red Bulls or like Cristal or anything. This is like a, anyway.
And on that note.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening, guys. Hope to see you again.
All right. Thanks for listening.